This is the third day of this October 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Japanese Zen master Bankei from the 17th century. And this, the text we're reading from is called Bankei Zen, edited by Peter Haskell. And he says, "Everyone, do exactly as I'm telling you, and, following my instructions, start by trying to abide in the unborn for 30 days. Learn to abide in the unborn," again, for people who may just be hearing this Teisho for the first time, first in this series, this you could translate as abiding the unborn is abiding in non-abiding, abiding in no thought, abiding in this pure, living, direct experience, unmediated by thoughts. Means abiding in no mind, abiding in mu. Learn to abide in the unborn for 30 days, and from there on, even if you don't want to, whether you like it or not, you'll just naturally have to abide in the unborn. You'll be a success at abiding in the unborn, since that which is unborn is the Buddha mind. You'll be functioning with the Buddha mind at all times. That way you'll be a living Buddha here. That way you'll be living Buddhas here today, won't you? So listen to my teaching just as if today you were all born anew and starting afresh. When you've got some fixed notion, you won't take in what you hear. Listen as if you were newly born right now, and it will be like hearing my teaching for the first time. If you don't have any fixed notion in your mind, at a single word, you'll instantly understand and attain complete realization of the Dharma. Listen as if you were all born anew and starting afresh. Beginner's mind. This is the mind uncluttered with notions, opinions, what we think we know. That's always what obstructs real knowing. When I was young, there was a notorious thief in these parts called the Kappa, a fellow on the order of Kumasaka Chohan, who would boldly rob people on the highway, seizing their money. He had remarkable genius as a thief. When he caught sight of someone coming from across the way, he could tell exactly how much money he had on him and was never off by even a hair. That's what a formidable fellow he was. However, one day he got himself nabbed and served a long term in the prison at Osaka. The years passed, and then, because he was such an expert as a thief, he found himself at an advantage and was spared execution to become an informer for the police. Later, he was excused from being an informer as well and became a free man. Afterward, he learned to carve Buddhist images, becoming a maker of Buddha figures and settling in Osaka, an expert now at carving Buddhas. Completely reversing his former wicked state of mind, he devoted himself to salvation and ended his days absorbed in chanting the Nembutsu. That's the main practice of the Pure Land school of Buddhism. So even such a notorious brigand as the Kappa, once he'd reformed ended his days in religious devotion. Where can you find anyone who steals because his karma is deep or his transgressions heavy? Stealing is the karma. Stealing is the transgression. If it weren't for stealing, that sin and transgression, that transgression and karma couldn't exist. Whether you steal or whether you don't depends on the present state of your own mind, not on your past karma. And what I'm telling you now doesn't go only for stealing. Generally speaking, all delusions are just the same as stealing. Whether you're going to be deluded or not all depends on the present state of your own mind. The present state of your own mind. When you're deluded, you're an unenlightened being. When you're not deluded, you're a Buddha. There's no special shortcut to being a Buddha beyond this. Isn't it so? Everyone, realize this conclusively. So yes, there is the force of karma, our past actions and our words and our past thoughts. There is some force there, but it is not determinative. It is just one factor. The other is our own, and then the predominant one is this present state of mind and how we work with those tendencies from the past. This is why Buddhism utterly rejects the notion of karma as fate. Fate implies it's out of our hands. And how could it ever be out of our hands when moment by moment we have a choice in how we're directing our attention and how we're reacting to things right now. We hear, we know that this is not, this kind of transformation is not so rare. There are people who have who in certain ways misuse their talents. So this thief misused his keen eye, his ability to judge how wealthy people were, and his skillful means at getting them to part from their money. There are other examples we know. People who when younger, have a talent for seducing others sexually, also have a keen intuitive sense and an ability to see the vulnerabilities, the needs of the person they're trying to seduce, and often a skillful use of words. And this too can be, as we know, can be turned around and used instead of for exploitative reasons and for one's own self-gratification, it can be used for good, to help people. And helping always starts with discerning, being able to discern what the person really needs. Seeing into the mind of the person, into the heart of the person. That's where it starts. Only then does one use whatever abilities, any whatever skills one has to help the person. Same with anger, I suppose. Some people, just by temperament, are more inclined to being hot-headed. And as I recently gave two consecutive teishos on anger, managing anger, the nature of anger, and this also we know that the force or the energy that can express itself as anger can also be employed in other ways. Harada Roshi, many of you know Harada Roshi, when he was an old man, he said that as a young man he had a terrible temper. Well, he took the energy behind that anger. He took the energy and just channeled it into his practice, his mu, and was able rather quickly to break through mu and see into his true nature. He still had to clean up the traces of that anger habit, but it was that he could then use for the greater good, the energy of the anger. I suppose you could say that people who have a vulnerability to substance abuse, I think often also have an ability to lose themselves. Certainly they have a longing to escape, to transcend the self. That's what intoxication, alcoholism, I think it very basically is a longing to get free of the self. And that also can be turned around. And sometimes such people have a greater ability than the average person to reach altered states of where they can let go and get beyond themselves. Someone asked, everybody says your reverence has the power to read people's minds. Is it true? The master said, in my school, we don't have such extraordinary things. And even if we did, since the Buddha mind is unborn, we wouldn't use them. When I'm speaking to you, I deal with your own selves. So you imagine I've got the power to read people's minds. But I haven't any mind-reading powers. I'm just the same as all of you. When you abide in the unborn, you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas. And without even having to seek supernatural power, all things are perfectly managed and smoothly dealt with. In the true teaching of the unborn, you can manage everything by dealing with your own self without bringing in all sorts of extraneous matters. And this is the important sentence. When you abide in the unborn, you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas. This is the core principle of Zen is rather than trafficking in psychic powers or other mental powers, see the source of them. See into mind itself, rather than dwelling in in moral concepts. See into the mind that gives rise to all moral systems. Go to the root. Don't waste time dwelling in the leaves and branches. Go to the root. Go to no mind. Not the various powers and other stuff of the mind, but no mind. A certain man asked, "I've practiced as hard as I can, trying to advance without slipping back. But no matter what I do, the tendency to backslide is strong, and there are times when I regress. However much I try to advance, I only fall back again. How can I keep from regressing?" The master said, "Abide in the unborn Buddha mind. When you do, you won't need to bother about advancing or regressing. In fact, when you abide in the unborn, trying to advance is to instantly regress from the place of the unborn. The man of the unborn has nothing to do with advancing or regressing, but always transcends them both." Well, this is what we can discover in a complete state of absorption. We call that samadhi. When we reach a samadhi, we are beyond such things. We see for ourselves, we experience this realm that has nothing to do with linear movement, coming or going, better or worse, more advanced, less advanced. We're free. We're free of all that. So long as we harbor any such notions, even in the back of our mind, any notions about making progress or not making progress, which most people do all the time. Most people have this in the back of their mind a lot. But as long as we do, then we're caught. We're caught in the world of change. And so we have a practice. We have a practice we're working on that has the power to deliver us from that bind of progress and regress. This is a deeply ingrained mental tendency that haunts many people in Sesshin and out, but it becomes especially conspicuous in Sesshin, where we may sit for 3 or 4 days or more, and in the back of the mind we're thinking, I'm not getting anywhere, or, oh, am I really getting somewhere? It doesn't matter which way we're thinking of it. We're still caught in this notion of linear movement, forward or back, up or down. It's so painful, really, and it's such a relief to reach this complete absorption in practice where these things don't bind us like that. There are no such thoughts to bind us. One day the master addressed the assembly. "All delusions, without exception, are created as a result of self-centeredness. When you're free from self-centeredness, delusions won't be produced." Let me pause there and just appreciate this for a minute. The whole problem is from self-centeredness. And there's another translation of Bonnke's teaching, and this phrase that this guy translates as self-centeredness, the other translates as self-partiality. Ego. Not just ego. We all need to develop a sense of self in our normal course of child development and maturing into adulthood. But it's attachment to the notion of a self. It's clinging to the I, the me and the my. This is the real problem. Houston Smith, in his book called Buddhism, which is a really excellent introduction to Buddhism and its various forms, he says when you look at a group photograph that you're in, whom do you look at first? Invariably, someone else called this our basic narcissism. This is what creates so much unnecessary suffering for us and for others. It's only by seeing the illusory nature of this self, of the I and the me and the my, it's only by seeing through it that we acquire some freedom from it. And we're not so driven by it. Almost all of our thoughts revolve around either, if not I or me, then my. It's just a slight extension of the self when we think in terms of my. Almost all of our thoughts revolve around the self and what we think of as ours. Chinese master said, why are people so unhappy? Because 99% of what they think about is themselves, and there is none. For example, he goes on, suppose your neighbors are having a quarrel. If you're not personally involved, you just hear what's going on and don't get angry. Not only do you not get angry, but you can plainly tell the rights and wrongs of the case. It's clear to you as you listen who's right and who's wrong. But let it be something that concerns you personally, and you find yourself getting involved with what the other party says or does, attaching to it and obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of the Buddha mind. Before, you could clearly tell wrong from right, but now, led by self-centeredness, you insist that your own idea of what's right is right, whether it is or not. Becoming angry, you thoughtlessly switch your Buddha mind for a fighting demon, and everyone takes to arguing bitterly with each other. Because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, the traces of everything you've done are spontaneously reflected. It's when you attach to these reflected traces that you produce delusion. Thoughts don't actually exist in the place where the traces are reflected and then arise. We retain the things we saw and heard in the past, and when these things come up, they appear as traces and are reflected. Originally, thoughts have no real substance. So if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, just let them arise. If they stop, just let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflected traces, delusions won't be produced. So long as you're not attaching to them, you won't be deluded. And then, no matter how many traces are reflected, it will be just as if they weren't reflected at all. Even if 100 or 1,000 thoughts spring up, it will be just the same as if they never arose. It won't be any problem for you. No thoughts to clear away. No thoughts to cut off. As I think I mentioned yesterday, thoughts are in Buddhism considered just another sense impression, like the other five, seeing, hearing, and so forth. It's natural. It's natural that all day long we hear sounds, we see sights. We taste, we smell, we feel, and we think. Thoughts come up, of course. That's not the problem, these thoughts that just file through the mind, and we just ignore them, just let them go. The problem is when we cling to them, when we pursue them, when we work them, when we chew on them. And that's what we're learning in Zazen, is to not do that, to see them, to notice them, and then just leave them alone. It's really that simple. We notice them and we leave them alone. We direct our attention back to the practice. It's difficult to do, we all know that, but it's quite simple, the instructions about what we need to do. The principal object of worship at Bankei's temple was a kanon made by the master. Knowing this, when the master was delivering a sermon, a monk stood leaning against a pillar, and that tells you everything, leaning against a pillar, and asked, "Is that an image? Is that image, let's say figure, is that figure an old Buddha or a new Buddha?" Now, let me just point out that in Asia, anything that is old, practically anything that's old, just by virtue of being old, is more worthwhile, is more worthy of respect, whether it's a person or a Buddha figure or a tradition. Age is, it confers value on things. So an old Buddha would be something seen as worthy of veneration, whereas a new Buddha, a newly made Buddha, would be much less so. So he asks, "Is that figure an old Buddha or a new Buddha?" And Bankei knows where he's going with this, so he says, "How does it look to you?" The monk said, "It looks to me like a new Buddha." The master said, "If it looks to you like a new Buddha, then it's a new Buddha, and that's that. So what's the problem?" Because you haven't understood that what is unborn is the Buddha mind, you come and ask this sort of useless thing, thinking that's Zen. Rather than ask this kind of worthless stuff and disturb everyone, just keep quiet. Take a seat and listen carefully to what I'm saying. A lot of these masters did not suffer fools. They didn't have time. There are all these other people they're trying to reach, and to have someone with this surly attitude, just try to display. It's just, of course, it's just ego on the part of that monk, just trying to impress people with how challenging he is. Here's one that concerns that includes the terms self-power and other power. For those who may not be familiar with these terms, self-power is just a designation. These are two designations for different types of Buddhist practice. Self-power would be where you look to your faith resides principally in something you see as within you, your own unborn Buddha mind, your own true nature. And other power, your faith resides in that which you see as other. So Zen is, traditionally, Zen was called something, an example of self-power. And the Pure Land School, where you worship the Buddha Amida, and it's a devotional practice where you look to Amida Buddha as your savior in a way. That would be an example of other power. He says, my teaching isn't concerned with either self-power or other power. That which transcends both self-power and other power, that's what my teaching is about. Let me prove this to you. While everyone is turned this way to hear me saying this, out back there may be sparrows chirping, crows cawing, the voices of men or women, or the sighing of the wind. But without your deliberately trying to hear every one of these sounds, each of them comes to you clearly recognized and distinguished. It's not you doing the hearing, so it's not a matter of self-power. On the other hand, since you can't very well have someone else do your hearing for you, you couldn't call it other power. So that which isn't concerned with self-power or other power, but transcends them both, is what my teaching is about. Well, like all categories, these two designations are just concepts. We don't need them. Why frame things in terms of self-power or other power? A monk asked, when I'm sleeping soundly, I have dreams. How is it that we have dreams? I'd like your opinion on this. The master said, when a person is sound asleep, he doesn't have dreams. When you have dreams, you're not sleeping soundly. The monk was speechless. I think this is long since been confirmed by sleep research, that our deepest sleep seems to be without the REM, rapid eye movement. It's easy to ponder the nature of dreams and really the nature of sleep. It really is fascinating. I read somewhere saying that to ask what the nature of sleep is really to ask what is the nature of consciousness. There's more research, I understand, into sleep, and that can be really very interesting, but strictly speaking, in Zen, we don't really have much use for analyzing our dreams or thinking about them at all, really. When you're thinking about your dreams of last night, where are you? Your mind is somewhere else. Here's another talk. What has brought this vast throng here like this since daybreak, hoping to hear what I've got to say, is none other than the unborn Buddha mind. The way you've all gathered here since early this morning, unless you'd felt the talk was something really unusual, you'd never have shown this sort of resolve. Well then, among those of you who've come to this meeting, all those who've reached the age of 50 have lived for 50 years without realizing you had the Buddha mind right within yourself. While those who are 30 have failed to realize this truth for 30 years up till today. You've all been passing the months and years in a daze. But at our meeting today, when you thoroughly grasp that each of you has the unborn Buddha mind right within himself, from today on, you'll live in the Buddha mind and be living Buddhas forever after. What I'm telling you all is simply to make you realize that the unborn Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating. I'm sure there's not a person present who objects to becoming a Buddha. That's why I'm here addressing you all. Even if I were to urge you all, forget about becoming Buddhas, just fall into hell, I doubt there would be a single one of you who'd actually volunteer to go. The proof of this is that in order to come to this meeting and hear my talk, you roused yourselves in the dark of night, traveling here, and jostling for space in this huge crowd, accepting all the hardships to listen to my talk. Isn't it because you all wanted to become Buddhas? Since you have this sort of resolve, from here on, you should take great care in everything you do. You know, the same thing, of course, could be noted about people who come to Sesshin. What brings us all here? It is a strong aspiration to be free, to live unencumbered by the fetters of thought. To be free. Don't ever doubt this. As far as any one person may know, it's not as profound as that. It's in your mind you may think you came just to make some progress in your practice and learn to sit more effectively. And sure, there's no doubt that that's true too. But fundamentally, there is this longing to know. It should be very encouraging to everyone that this great, great well of aspiration is within each one of us. And we draw from this well every time we bring our mind back to the practice. Every time we refrain from pursuing our thoughts and just redirect that attention to our practice. We're going back to the well when we do that. And then Bankei continues, just what sort of thing is this unborn Buddha mind? You're probably wondering. While all of you here are turned this way, intent on hearing what I'm saying, if outside the temple there's the barking of a dog or the cry of some tradesman peddling his wares, even though you're not trying to hear these things in the course of the talk, each of the different sounds is heard. The dog's bark, the tradesman's cry, that's hearing with the unborn, the dynamic function of the Buddha mind. Let me give you an example. The Buddha mind, unborn and marvelously illuminating, is like a bright mirror. A mirror reflects whatever is in front of it. It's not deliberately trying to reflect things, but whatever comes before the mirror, its color and form are sure to appear. Likewise, when the object being reflected is removed, the mirror isn't deliberately trying not to reflect it, but when it's taken away, it doesn't appear in the mirror. The unborn Buddha mind is just like this. It's natural that you see and hear things, whatever they are, when you deliberately try to see and hear them. But when you see and hear things that you hadn't originally anticipated seeing or hearing, it's through the dynamic function of the Buddha mind that every one of you has. That's what's meant by the unborn Buddha mind. In other words, his point is that it's not something that we have to develop, this mind. We don't have to build it up. It is within us. It is our mind. It's beyond developing or failing to develop. It's our birthright, this Buddha mind, unborn. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.